There were a number of questions this afternoon and this morning, and some of these questions probably you'll have a reply about this evening, and others will be probably answered tomorrow morning. One of these questions is, how can this practice be integrated in our daily lives? The big question that no doubt comes up. You know, we've been in a very protected environment, safe, extremely conducive to the practice, and so it's totally valuable to have that type of question come up. The other question is how to keep it going. So all these questions are very meaningful, actually. And I think it's an aspect that I'd like to talk about tonight is to understand that the value of the teachings is not restricted to a certain form. Otherwise, it has a very limited value, actually. So if we broaden the perspective, we understand that the scope of the Buddha's teachings or spiritual practice or developing the mind, purifying the heart, has a meaning where we have the intention to keep waking up. And in a broader way, this means that in our life, we keep waking up. Waking up to what? To our reality, to the moment, to what is. And we try the best we can to not fall back to sleep. Which means in dreamland, in automatic pilot, habitual tendencies. And that doesn't need a protected environment. So it's extremely valuable to question and to really underline again and again our motivation for practice. And especially if we've been on the path for some time. When we're new, and I've sensed this over the days, this retreat, it's just so refreshing to have beginners, actually. And I really would like to thank you, because there's, I keep on saying that having a fresh mind is so valuable and important, and the freshness that you've brought has again brought so much joy and gratitude to this mind and body, who's me, in relationship to offering the teachings in so many circumstances and in many ways. And it's wonderful to see that there's such potential in these teachings. And when there is that kind of newness, there's a clarity, a freshness which comes up. So, keeping on having the scope and on being on track in relationship to what do we want to nourish, and that the nourishment can be manifesting in our everyday life, if the motivation is here. One of my dear friends and teacher, both, Joseph Goldstein, who's well known in the U.S. as a teacher. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he says, everything rests on the tip of motivation, which means that if we have the motivation, we wake up. And we wake up from the dreamland, from the conditioning. Exactly like I said last night, every moment there's a possibility of breaking that chain of habitual tendency towards attachment and aversion. If the scope is wide enough, so we can be aware every moment. And this is not just for one day, you know, as another teacher would say, he says, we know what we have to do. It's pretty easy. I mean, the understanding is not very complicated. What's difficult is to do, to actually do it, because it's so easy to go in the other direction. And everything in our culture calls us kind of in the other direction. So to go opposite really requires quite a lot of courage. So we remind ourselves to stay mindful. And of course it helps to do formal practice. But this is not only about sitting on a cushion. And if we reduce the practice to sitting on a cushion, then of course it's going to be a very limited amount of time in relationship to the time that we have in this world. And it's not always that we will make that a priority. Because then it becomes yet another thing that we have to make time for on the very long list of things we need to do. And therefore, it's often something which we will not integrate. So it's much more helpful, at least for me, to see it as a way of life. It's the way of living with which we live our lives. Being present when we do our yoga, being present when we wash dishes, being present when you're speaking to a friend, listening wholeheartedly to your children if you have any, or your parent. This is the practice. And it's not separate from our integrated daily life. This is exactly where the practice needs to flourish. And of course, these specific circumstances do help us see more clearly in relationship to what is still entangled within me. And there's no doubt that this is extremely precious, and I do encourage people to do retreat. But then the practice doesn't stay here. It goes out with you, and you keep on manifesting it, expressing it, and remembering to be calling forth that quality of presence, of mindfulness. So it's a different scope, for sure. In the same way that I like to integrate and understand that a day on retreat is composed of mindfulness every moment. And so many times do we hear people say, yeah, I'm doing a lot of effort when I sit on the cushion, and eventually some walks, and the rest of the time I give myself breaks, all these in-between moments. It's exactly the same. If we integrate it as a way of life, then it's seamless. The day becomes a day where there's this quality of natural presence, which at least we're intending to have. So it's in the motivation. Really, there's a whole lot of amount in relationship to intention. In that case, it's doable. It's workable. Even if we forget a million times in the day. But the seed of intention is here. It's present. And that changes everything. So we understand that the mindfulness practice is about developing wisdom, and that we can do that every single moment. That wisdom mind can flourish any moment. And that's wonderful to have that be a potential. Any situation, even the most difficult situation at work, if it's a stressful situation, can be exactly that place where we can learn. As the Dalai Lama says, the most difficult places and even outside are the places that wake us up the most if we're willing to look and to see in a correct way. So it's not about sitting just a few minutes and then forgetting about it. At least that's not how I see it. And of course, we'll be able to talk a bit about that tomorrow morning if you have more questions. And that's why I'm talking about this tonight, because it often is a different way of seeing kind of the meditation practice than we may think. It's much more broad, and therefore there may be questions coming up which will be answered tomorrow. It's really a living process and being fully alive. Another source of development, as you've been able to see and maybe touch upon just a little bit, we haven't done much, is developing these wholesome qualities of heart and mind. The one that we've been cultivating just a little bit is this quality of metta, of loving kindness. They are positive qualities. There are other ones that are named compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. And they really counteract those mental states that bring a lot of pain. You can say that they are even antidotes to the painful mind states. And therefore, cultivating them is a way that we are enabling the heart, the mind, to open and to care a little more in relationship to what is manifesting, which is painful, and in all kinds of circumstances. Here again, it's not only happening on a cushion that we're able to have this development of the caring heart. As wisdom grows, and I said this, metta or kindness will naturally flourish, just because of the openness rather than staying closed and the quality of balance which comes with it. Balance meaning having a little more acceptance and willingness to feel rather than to stay closed. That's the purpose, you can say, of this wonderful quality of heart, which is called metta. It's unconditional, and someone asked me, what does it mean? It means that it's not bound to certain circumstances, which means that it's able to slowly, slowly flourish towards all beings. And the aim, the scope, you can say, is this quality of heart which manifests in relationship to every single being. And this, of course, means that we move a little bit more than the habitual way of living, where there are maybe 5-10 people that I really care about in my life that are tender to me, right? Which is normal. Maybe 20 if we have a generous heart. And all the rest of the people, we don't really care about. We don't know them, and often there's indifference. And so this quality of metta is have a wider scope. And the understanding about unconditional is that it doesn't need for me to know that person. The metta is there and present, whatever their circumstances. It's called the boundless heart. And so, of course, this requires some practice to reach that state of boundlessness, but it's at ease, at least, in all circumstances. And therefore, there's a movement of openness, which naturally brings a lot of peace and also a lot of joy, because it doesn't need to be constantly protected or defensed. That quality of heart doesn't need to be constantly contained. There's a sense of trust which emerges from this quality. So this path that we're practicing is about developing this wisdom and developing the kindness, the compassion. The compassion is the quality of kindness that we've been cultivating in relationship to pain. It's exactly that quality that we've touched upon, and it's called compassion when there is pain that is present. So rather than having this calling forth of the positive and seeing the good and really noticing this aspect of wonderful quality to connect with the positive, we are able then with compassion practice to have this metta be present, this kindness present in the face of pain, and calling forth, may I care about the pain. It's the same quality, but opening to pain rather than closing or shutting down in the face of pain. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about metta. Maybe another time I'll talk about compassion. Not this retreat, but maybe another retreat. Because we've been practicing metta. And so it's said that the metta is, you can say, the moisture that sustains us and celebrates our place in the web of this world. And the image of this lake is perfect, actually. Because we arrived here and a lot of that lake was frozen. I don't know if you remember how different the scenery looked. It was amazing. And that's exactly the image that a heart may be a little contracted or a mind contracted. And slowly, slowly with metta, with moisture, with a little bit of warmth, it defreezes. And have you seen the lake with the warmth? It's exactly what happened. Beautiful flow of water which manifests. This is exactly what happens in our own heart and mind in relationship to the melting of the heart. And that's called tenderness. Adyashanti, who is a contemporary American, said to be enlightened master, wonderful teacher whom I like a lot. He says, wisdom without love is like having lungs but no air to breathe. Do not seek wisdom in order to acquire knowledge, but in order to live and love more fully. That's the meaning of wisdom. When there is this quality of wisdom which comes forth and we see clearly, we purify, naturally the expression is the love. The expression is the kindness. They really are bound. And in the teachings, there's a beautiful image of a bird. And it said that the bird will only fly with two wings And in the same way, the teachings will manifest only with two wings. One wing is the wing of wisdom, and the other is the wing of love and compassion. So they need to be connected. There's a real quality, and I can say this from experience, that for many years I was very attached, I can say, to doing the Vipassana practice, not wanting at all to touch the metta, probably not noticing that underlying fear was there and not going into the direction until the practice was manifesting in a very dry way. That flow of water which we see there was definitely not present in this body and mind. And I could have hours sitting on the cushion and being very clear, have a sharp mind. It was desert. And the invitation was to really bring in metta practice. And there was some resistance, I can say, until one day I felt so in pain that I took the advice and began the metta practice. This is years back. And since then, everything changed. It's interesting how that specific quality has enabled a transformation of being able to face the pain, which the wisdom was there, but there wasn't the connection to meet the difficulty. And it's not uncommon. It's absolutely not uncommon. And it's wonderful because in the West, we often teach both practices. When I'm saying that I was practicing with Vipassana only, it was also because I had practiced many months in Asia, and that the mode there was not to bring that kind of practice in. So it's only when I began in the West that I was kind of offered these teachings, which are extremely valuable, I find. So we're dedicating, when we do practice metta, to consciously, and you can notice here that there's an intention, to develop the kindness, the goodness, the willingness. And there's no doubt that the first thing that one will find, if one would be like me at the beginning, would be exactly the opposite states. Underlying an unconscious aversion, self-hate, self-denial, a lot of resentment, all these mind states that are not very pleasant, but that need to be met at one point if they're underneath and they're hidden and completely suppressed. So, of course, this is what happened in the practice. And just to meet them with kindness, just to be there and present with the quality of mindfulness, but the flavor of metta changed the atmosphere, changed the inner atmosphere. And that's exactly the value of these teachings. So if you have some sense that you're struggling in one way or another in relationship to difficult emotions, I would definitely advise and invite you to bring in that flavor of metta. Include it in your practice, no matter what you're doing. Because it is the profound goodwill. It's the profound goodwill with what is quite extraordinary is that with this quality, there's a shift in relationship to the sincerity of heart with which we relate to ourselves. Which for me at least, and I've seen from quite a number of people practicing, had not been there if it would only be the wisdom practice, the honesty, the sincerity, and that's profoundly transformative. And what is the sincerity? Is to offer that goodwill instead of staying in the defense system, which can be a place where we can be very stuck and for a long time. So there's this presence of generosity. Metta is a mind state that we all have. So it's not to look for outside of ourselves. It's here. It's present. Exactly the same as anger. It doesn't need to be created. It just needs to be rediscovered. So, and it comes after some time, even if it feels completely neutral for a very long time. And I can say that for quite a long time, as I said, I was certainly not feeling the kindness, but the opposite mind states, and it's normal. Yet the very fact that it was moving and that there was some kind of thing happening where I was in connection, not in connection with pleasant, but in connection, that's already a step forward. And then naturally there's a purifying effect which comes along. So a lot of this practice is purifying the obstacles to the radiance of this kindness or love. Some people like to call it love. I find this love, this word a little bit used for everything and nothing, so it's kind of distorted to my mind, but, you know, the radiance of love, we can absolutely use the word love here, unconditional love. So we stretch our heart in a way. We expand it to include those mind states that are not maybe included otherwise, that we just keep away. And the practice works in a way where we begin with ourselves, then as you've seen, we have plenty of possibilities of extending this metta and these wishes to people we know well, to people that we are with at ease with. And we also extend in the practice sometimes to people we don't know, just for the sake of feeling the neutrality and how much there can be indifference. And with this quality of kindness, the environment changes completely. And that when you do meet people in your environment or in life in general, at least you see a human being rather than absolutely nobody. When this practice evolves, there's a sense of also being able to see what we have in common. The sense of separation that comes from me feeling separate from you, or you, or you, or you, right, is often because we see through the perspective of what's different. And what is that? It's the judging mind that does that. Constantly, oh, this is judging, this is judging, this is judging, and this makes us feel so different from them. So it separates, and it constantly separates. Now, it may be a way that we defend ourselves this way, but it's a false defense. Actually, it separates us from ourselves, this way of being. And so what the metta practice does, and it's extremely beautiful when it happens, is that we're able to see what's in common. Rather than constantly see the differences, because it's non-judgmental attention, it doesn't have judgments, then it can see, what do we have in common? This human has this in common with me. And then there's a flow of connection, which is not based in separation, but is based in sameness. And that is certainly a different way of living. This is from the Buddha. He said, "Whatever kinds of worldly merit there are, all are not worth 1/16th part of the heart deliverance of loving kindness. In shining and beaming and radiance, the heart deliverance of loving kindness far excels them." He gave a lot of value to this quality of heart. It's amazing. When one begins to look, it's really not a side practice. It's completely present in the teachings. And so it's nice to take that to heart. Just because what he explained is that a mind filled with metta, it gives a sense of lightness, of spaciousness, and it's really a nice place for the mind to dwell. Rather than dwell in anger, aversion, and attachment, it's nice to hang out with metta. So why not? So doing this practice, we're creating conditions for happiness and joy. We awaken happiness and joy exactly in the same way that there is awakening joy, which is mudita, empathetic joy, which is another quality very linked to metta. It's the possibility to rejoice in the happiness of other beings. Another wonderful, spacious quality. So this is from the Buddha. We create wholesome habits instead of unwholesome habits. This is exactly what this type of practice does. And the Buddha says this in the Dhammapada. He says, "The thought manifests as the word. The word manifests as the deed. The deed develops into habit." The deed meaning the action. Huh? And habit hardens into character. You see the loop, the conditioning? Thought manifests as the word manifests as the deed develops into habit, and habit hardens into character. Right? So watch the thought and its way with care. And let it spring from love born out of concern for all beings. That is exactly what the practice of metta can do. Now, what's wonderful with this practice is that not only does it bring less isolation for oneself, and really a lot less isolation as we practice it, but it also gives a great softness and pliability to the mind. There's so much more openness and flexibility that we can take in life circumstances in a much more smooth way than with the hardened character, stiff. And what's great is that it can be practiced anywhere. You don't need a silent space. I practice metta so often in airports, because I am often in airports, right? And there are beings around me in airports, on an airplane, in trains, in buses. It's amazing how easy it is to practice this practice. Instead of having the random thoughts and the thoughts that just, you know, preoccupy the mind or make a space out, to have this quality of mind which is just tuned into this word of metta, first of all, it gives a sense of concentration because it is a concentration practice. And it purifies. And so we feel so much lighter. And you can really, I'm sensing that there's a cleansing effect to this quality of practice. So anywhere, anytime. So part of our journey, as I said earlier, is learning what metta isn't. And often, with all these practices, there is a near neighbor. And we confuse this quality, which is unconditional and very open, with the near neighbor, which is attachment. And that's very common. So attachment, which we can call desire, right? It's the same kind of impulse, except desire and attachment has a lot of self in it. There's a lot of wanting, exactly the wanting that I talked two nights ago, or three nights, I can't remember when. The need, the expectation, right? The wanting back. What can I get from this? The expectation of a result, the outcome. And so we're going to be meeting this as we progress. But this is exactly what we're purifying. It's the desire and the wanting, which is so present and that we're inclined to, purifies into a much more open kindness, gentleness, and if we want to use the word love, we can use love. Love without self-interest, right? So in a relationship, for example, there's less of the sense of, okay, I'm sending out love or metta to this person, but they're not behaving the way that I'm. Think they should behave, right? What happened? There isn't that in the relationship when it's true metta. And no doubt that we're going to be going through all these phases because it's part of the journey where the desire and the attachment are going to be met and going to say, oh, okay, this isn't completely pure, but it's fine because I'm on my way, right? It's part of the path. And to see the wanting, to see the attachment, to see the desire. Because all of these practices are really allowing ourselves to see more of the emotional aspect. And you've probably seen this, that we're more clearly manifesting and being with the emotional side of things. So love or metta is often confused with attachment. And it's just part of the process, and when we recognize that, it's fine. It's okay. It's just a way that we are purifying the process. Another aspect is when we practice this full humanity, you can say, or strengthened weaknesses of our own being, we also understand about change and uncontrollability, that we can't control. That even if we are expressing a lot of metta to a friend, for example. And I've had a friend who had cancer, and no doubt that I was very present for her. And when I was teaching, a lot of my time on this cushion, when I sit here in front of you, she died now, so it didn't happen this retreat, but quite a while ago, a lot of it was spending time to really send her metta and to be able to just, you know, care for her, because I couldn't be near her physically. And so there was a sense of really seeing that the circumstances were not going in the side of cure. And no doubt that this being had her own life, and we understand that it's not about being able to interfere or to do something. It's beyond our control. And yet, that's exactly the state where we can still care. We can still be present for that human being as best we can. And that's the metta. So it's, you know, I could have said, oh, I've done something wrong, or I didn't, you know, my metta wasn't strong enough. That's the way that we can take things, right? Where we have a sense where, okay, it failed. It's not about failure. It's just circumstances that sometimes, you know, life just doesn't go the way that we would like it to go. And so that's the deeper understanding where we have wisdom. And wisdom without love, love without wisdom, they both work completely together, where we really then just accept the things the way they are. And that's cultivating this wonderful quality of equanimity. Being in balance and allowing acceptance of the way things are. So the wisdom is always present in relationship to this quality of metta, of kindness too. Not separate. Balancing out that there's in life all the joys and the sorrows, and we do the best we can, and we're not in control. That's having a big heart, actually. Or a wide open mind to be able to take in all the events of life. And so we really infuse that understanding more and more, and in the best way that we can. For ourselves and for other beings. So if this happens, you should really not feel that you're doing it wrong, because it would be a misunderstanding, a real misunderstanding. A Zen teacher says, practice is about learning to be kind, but we will never be kind until we truly experience our unkindness. So that's another aspect, that we need to be able to touch upon the anger, the aversion, and that's exactly what I was talking about when I began the metta practice. I really touched the unkindness. And fortunately, and this is true, it's not possible to go and find the light without meeting the shadow. And the shadow side of ourself needs to emerge and surface to be able to have a complete being, a being which is whole. Otherwise, there's always one side that's going to be fragmented and separated from the other. So the unkindness is something that we need to accompany and offer kindness to. And it's very easy for us to be in denial of our unkindness. We don't like to go into that space and those spots that hurt. And yet, if we want to transform ourselves, it's needed at the pace that we can. So it means that metta practice isn't always pleasant. But if it's not pleasant, don't abandon it, because it means that it's working. From my own experience, it means that something is transforming. On the road to, you know, unconditional metta, we're going to find obstacles. And it's okay. We can always, you know, step back and ground ourselves in our wisdom practice. So the ultimate goal is to develop this boundless heart for all beings. And no doubt that at times it's easier to bring in an aspect of all beings, spaciousness, rather than stay with individuals, as I was suggesting earlier, because of the lightness and the openness. And to have a sense that with all beings, there definitely are beings that are suffering. And therefore, when the obstacles seem to be really difficult, it's very good to then integrate compassion practice. To just tune in to the pain. Right? And the words, the phrases are not very different. It's may I be free from this pain, one phrase, or may I care about this pain. May I care about receiving the pain in kindness. So all of these different modes that we have that may be included so we are able to move on and feel that there's a quality of being held and holding ourselves. How am I relating to my experience? Is it with inclusion, with kindness, or simply feeding the reactivity? So you see how much metta is needed. And it can be done in a formal metta practice. It can also be done, as I said so many times during this retreat, in an informal way where we have the flavor of this kindness in our vipassana practice, which then becomes a little more informal. So I'll close with a quote from Pema Chodron, the English Tibetan nun. I think she's American, actually. Anyhow, doesn't much matter. Her quote is this one: when you begin to touch your heart or let your heart be touched, you begin to discover that it is bottomless, that it doesn't have any resolution, that this heart is huge, vast, and limitless. You begin to discover how much warmth and gentleness is there, as well as how much space. And this is exactly what metta will offer. Begin to touch your heart, or let your heart be touched. You begin to discover that it is bottomless, that it doesn't have any resolution, that this heart is huge, vast, and limitless. You begin to discover how much warmth and gentleness is there, as well as how much space. So, thank you for listening.